Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Fred Rogers used television to teach children about kindness and compassion. Warren Buckleitner, a senior fellow of the Fred Rogers Center, has applied those same values to teaching children who have grown up with computers. Warren Buckleitner also is editor for Children's Technology Review and a regular guest on Tech Tuesday. Welcome back, Warren.
Good to be with you, Ann.
Let's talk about those values you wrote about. The first one was honest. It has to be honest.
Right. Yes. I think, you know, what I was trying to do is think, if Fred were alive today, what would he be thinking about what's going on in the app stores and with the way media has proliferated in so many ways? Mm-hmm. And, you know, honesty was in the DNA of Fred. He was always straight up. He'd look right at the camera and tell it the way it was, even with tough issues like death or assassinations or and so on. And I think he'd look for those kinds of things in apps.
Another one, empowering. You said he wanted children to experience feelings of control.
Right. He always wanted the child to be in control. The place Fred got all this stuff was from child development theory. So he was basically a good early childhood educator. So I think our preschool teachers would say same thing. And I think that's one reason his message resonates. But he'd always want apps that make children feel powerful or make children feel in control. And a lot of experiences sort of remove that control.
And then child paced, I think that was an interesting observation as well.
Yeah, if you see the documentary, there's this one moment that's amazing where Fred lets a tortoise walk across the floor, and everyone's like, hurry up, hurry up. But Fred was very much about thinking about time and letting time take its own course. And so that sort of, again, runs against the grain of a lot of popular children's media.
Here's another one, supportive of human interactions. Media has been blamed, you know, the technology has been blamed for separating us from each other.
Exactly. And technology is a powerful instrument, and it can be used to bring people together or to build walls between people. And there are apps that actually give two players turns. There's also some wonderful video games like Super Smash Brothers, and you know, with 8 controllers. And if you watch a group of teenagers playing a game like that, the interactions between them are something I think Fred would be very supportive of.
And of course, well crafted. Everything he did was very meticulous. What do you think he would make of today's technology?
I think Fred would be raising a voice about encouraging us all to make better use of the technology that we have. You know, we can put the world's greatest symphonies in every child's earbuds, but we're not doing that because of the amount of distraction in the app stores. So I think our whole culture is trying to assimilate and figure out how to use this technology. Unfortunately, there's a lot of what Fred would call pies in the face, you know, not using it to enrich children or making their lives better, but pretty much wasting time. And so I think there's a lot of things we could do better. And I think Fred would be speaking up about that.
You mentioned a few apps. You said there's quite a few apps that meet these standards, but you picked 3 that stand out. One is, I think we've talked about, it's Sago, right? Sago Mini Farm?
Yep. The Sago series, SAGO from Sago Mini. It's a Canadian studio. And it has all those attributes we described, child control. It's empowering. It's still, you know, it doesn't make noise. If the child stops touching the screen, it just sits there. And, you know, it lets you know you're alive. It's alive and waiting for you, but it doesn't push the content at you. And so all their stuff is great. And that's what I tried to do in choosing these three apps, was lead you to companies that sort of understand these principles.
Right. For Sago, it's ages 2 to 5, the Sago Mini Farm 2 to 5. Another one was the Human Body for ages 4 and up. And we've talked about that one before, too.
I know, we did. That's TinyBot. But TinyBot is still making stuff. Both of those apps, by the way, are not free. So you have to spend, hold on your seat, $2,
right,
maybe $1, right, for these experiences. But there's no gimmicks, in-app purchases, and it's worth every penny. So these companies need to get the message that people are willing to spend, you know, the price of a cup of coffee for their products, and it's worth it. So TinyBot makes these apps that I think Fred would like, because do you remember, Ann, did you ever watch the Mr. Rogers Neighborhood?
Oh, yes.
Okay, so do you remember the times when he'd take you to places like the Crayon Factory?
And, yes.
Yeah.
So how things are made kind of a thing.
Exactly. And he always liked to show children how things work and the people behind the product, so that when, you know, you're playing with a toy, there's actually, you know, humans that made it and the machines and so on that made them work. And I think that's what the TinyBot apps do. You can look inside the human body. That's the one it's one of my favorites, because you can see how your heart works in a way that's non-scary, and it sort of explains things. And I think Fred understood that when you can explain something or put something into words, it helps you deal with it. And there's a lot of mysteries and things that are potentially frightening to children, and the TinyBot apps do that.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Warren Buckleitner, a senior fellow at the Fred Rogers Center and also editor of the Children's Technology Review. And we're talking about apps for children that reflect the values of Fred Rogers. Warren Buckleitner recently wrote about it for the Fred Rogers Center, and where he is, like I said, a senior fellow. We'll have a link to that article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question for Warren about children's apps, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. A third one you brought up was Crazy Gears. And here's what, when I was reading your description of it, it sounded like it was 3D. It wasn't an app. Because you said the parts snap together easily. And that
really threw me off. you can chalk that up to some poor writing.
No, not at all. But it made me curious. So tell us about this.
Yeah, well, it's all on a screen. So let's be clear about that. It's an app you download. And there's a bunch of gears, you know, virtual gears laying in front of you on the multi-touch surface, and they're just sitting there, and you can, when you move one close to another, they sort of snap. So there's a feeling of like, they're almost like magnetic.
Mm-hmm.
And so you start to understand that they spin, and then little gears spin faster and have more power, and all of these really complicated science relationships that you can never explain with words, but once you manipulate them, you know, I like to call them virtual manipulative. So because they let you think with your fingers, and, you know, not every kid can have the childhood of a Seymour Papert where you can play with differentials and, you know, these kinds of relationships. But, you know, for a couple bucks, you can get an app that lets children play with this. And, you know, this is another one. There are many other apps. This is from Edoki Academy, a French studio, and they make a whole bunch of other really powerful apps because the people behind these experiences are educators. They understand child development, and they have not compromised their ethics by making them free and then putting in app purchases that trick children.
Well, which, again, it's trick children, yeah, and also distract them from the, you know, making it so something that you have to, transactional, that you have to keep buying to play it.
Exactly. And not that that's all that bad, as long as it's described up front and presented in a way children can understand. But what I'm worried about, and what I think Fred Rogers would be concerned with, is the general culture of manipulation in which children are sucked into whenever they go into either iTunes or Google Play or even Amazon. And it's because there's so much free material, and it looks really good. Some of it is sort of, you know, there's kittens and so on, and you want to download it. But some of these are actually carefully engineered behavioral experiences designed to separate you from your money. And they basically sort of tease children. And I think that one of the biggest dangers is that it distracts children and parents from apps like the ones I'm describing that I think Fred Rogers would highly encourage us to give to our children.
Tell me how these three apps are supportive of human interactions.
Well, some of them are stronger than others, but like, let's take the human body, for example. That's the kind of thing where you could sit with a child and just say, what happened, right? And that's a great question to ask. When your child's playing, you sit next to him and say, what would happen if? And like, what happens if you touch there? Or what happens if you do this or whatever? It's called guided discovery. Mm-hmm. And so you let their hands do it. That's a fabulous kind of experience, because the app basically sits there and you can do stuff with it. You can experiment, you can try stuff out. So these kinds of experiences are ones that are very versatile. They work with a group of kids or one kid, a curious child. You know, it's just really good. And, you know, I was a teacher, and I can, when I see stuff like that, it's like, these are the reasons we spend the money on these devices.
You know, I was wondering what your thoughts are about Pokemon Go, because, one of my guests, one of my regulars, Russell Holly, has said what a great thing it's been to kind of get up with his kids and go out and do something physical while you're in that sort of, a virtual world.
Yeah, and it's an example of geo games, you know, or the geolocation games that, you know, the technology that the billions of dollars we invested in putting those satellites can be used for making our devices smart. And Pokemon Go is really the tipping point for this genre of game. And I love it. But I do think that what I would like Apple and Google to do is fully disclose at the point of purchase how much Pokemon Go could potentially cost you. Mm-hmm. And that's a mystery, because right now it says free. And then you have to read the reviews and you can see, oh, my kid spent, you know, how much. Now, I personally play Pokemon Go, and I think that it's worth maybe $10-$15, if you compare it with the amount of time that you spend. Certainly, I've gotten enough joy out of it is compared to seeing a movie, for example, which is $10-$15 for a ticket these days. So, you know, it's all relative. But what I don't like is when apps and when children are involved with a situation where something is, quote, free, and it's not disclosed. You don't know how much it will cost. And then they're eventually teased. And Pokemon Go does that. You run into a situation where you can't collect any more Pokemon because you have to buy more space in your Pokemon bag. And so it puts you in a situation where you have to pay up or you can't play. Now, when that happens, there's a whole bunch of kids who don't have data plans. Mm-hmm. Or don't have a parent that will give them the money. So it's an economic, cultural thing that's going on here that we need to understand, because, you know, there's a whole divide of children who can't play Pokemon Go. So they can't participate in the geolocation digital culture. And, how do we address that?
Warren Buchleiter, always good to hear from you. I know I'm going to be asking you to come on again as we approach the holidays for your suggestions for holiday gifts along these lines for children. So look forward to hearing from you then as well.
Always a pleasure, Ann.
Warren Buchleitner, he's a senior fellow at the Fred Rogers Center, and he's editor of the Children's Technology Review. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A Pew Research study showed that 6 out of 10 American teens have experienced cyberbullying or online harassment, everything from name-calling to explicit photos. Those surveyed told the Pew researchers that they felt social media companies and their teachers don't do enough to address it. This month, tech giant Google, with the National PTA, launched an education platform to teach parents how to help. Jessica Covarrubias is the lead of Google's Be Internet Awesome project. She joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Why team with the PTA?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I think it's important to first start with the program overall. Be Internet Awesome is a program that we developed maybe about a year and a half ago in conjunction with a number of online safety experts to teach kids how to navigate the internet safely, positively, and with confidence. We've developed kind of 5 core pillars to teach kids all about the internet. And together, these pillars are what I call the driver's license to the internet for kids. The 5 pillars that we have are smart, alert, kind, strong, and brave. And within each of them, we teach kids about a different topic that they may encounter online. So, for example, in the smart pillar, we teach kids all about what they share matters online, right? Whether it's good or bad, it could follow you for the rest of your life. So really teaching them the importance of their digital footprint and also just to be cautious with what they share with people that they know and don't know.
So why team with the PTA for this?
Yeah. So what we noticed in the development of this program is that primarily the program is focused with classrooms, with students in the classroom, right? So we have a curriculum developed for teachers, and then we have a game that reinforces all of the concepts of the program. And in the process of rolling out this program, what we realized is the parents want to have these conversations at home with kids, but oftentimes don't know where to start or where to look to for resources. So we partnered with the National PTA to begin including parents into the online safety conversation with their families. And so we developed assets that are specific to the home to help guide these conversations with their children. So we're partnering with the PTA first and foremost on a program to call out all local PTA chapters across the United States to host family workshops for parents to attend and to learn more about online safety and how to have these conversations with their kids. And so that's kind of the first phase of us reaching parents, but we're looking to do 200 workshops nationally. And we've developed special family resources, both bilingual, so in English and Spanish, to give parents the tools to empower them to have these conversations at home with their kids.
I read that it's designed specifically to teach parents. How does teaching parent, you know, what does that look like? How do you do that differently than how you would teach teachers or teach children directly?
Yeah, so we developed the program with the teacher in mind, with the students and the teacher in mind. And so the curriculum for teachers has, you know, discussion guides, student activities. It's quite robust. But for parents, obviously that is too much information to kind of give a parent. So what we've done is we've created a guide that is made specifically for parents that makes all of these different types of concepts around online safety and positive behavior understandable in little bite sizes with activities that parents and families can relate to. So, for example, October is National Bullying Prevention Month. And so to your point, one of the pillars of Be Internet Awesome is to teach kids how to be kind, right? So we want to emphasize the importance of treating others how you'd like to be treated, both in the real world as well as online. So a part of the materials that we give parents to complement what kids are learning in the classroom is, one, we're giving them tips to understand whether or not cyberbullying is happening in their child's life, whether it's to them or around them. We just want to give kind of those additional resources for them to kind of manage those conversations. Additionally, we give parents guidance on how to kind of model positivity, how to model, being an upstander, right? So standing up to bullying in the home so that kids can feel comfortable talking about these things at home. And as a family together, you can kind of address these topics.
Is there an age group that you're shooting for here?
Yes. So Be Internet Awesome, we designed it with 7 to 12-year-olds in mind. So kind of that elementary school, middle school level. The program has multiple components, right? So there's the classroom component, which is the curriculum for teachers. We also have a number of assets for teachers, resources to just pull and help them teach this in the classroom. For kids, we have the game Interland that complements the curriculum. And again, it's almost like sneaking the vegetables into a child's meal, and that they're learning all of these concepts about online safety, but in a fun and engaging way that they're so used to, right, being tech natives. And at the end of each of the levels in the game, there's also a quiz that kind of teaches them. And then finally, you know, this partnership that we just launched with the PTA, that gives us the opportunity to build up the resources for parents. So together, it's a family approach. But from the classroom perspective, we truly designed this for kind of elementary school. It's the driver's license to the internet. So we want to make sure that we're building the next generation of, digital citizens with the right tools and information as they begin to become more frequent users of the internet.
You're giving $1,000 to PTAs across the country to set up Be Internet Awesome workshops. What were the criteria for getting these grants?
Yeah, absolutely. So we partnered with the PTA to develop an application process for this grant. One, we wanted to understand whether or not there was a need for this type of information within the local PTA. So within the application, they have to kind of identify, what are some concerns that their school community has had as it relates to the internet or technology, and would a workshop on online safety, would that be beneficial to your community, whether it be in English or Spanish? So again, all of the resources that we're pushing out for Be Internet Awesome specific to the parent community will be bilingual. And the program is also bilingual. It's available in English as well. But within these workshops, we're asking for the need for information around online safety. We also just want to understand the appetite for this type of content among parents. And so those are really the two biggest things that we look for. And so the PTA will then vet through all of the applications and identify all the 200 winners. But what's great is at every state will have at least 3 family workshops going on starting in the beginning of 2019.
You said every state.
Every state. Every single state will have at least 3 family workshops being put on around online safety. So I would encourage folks to get their local PTAs to apply for one of these grants.
Can parents get access to these tools without having a PTA involved in it?
Yes. So what is happening maybe in a couple of months is all of the materials that we've developed specific to the Be Internet Awesome kits that we're rolling out with the National PTA will also be available on our website. So everything is 100% free. The entire program is free for students, for educators, for everyone. And all of those materials will be available on our website as well, just for easy download.
Why is Google doing this?
So Google, as a big internet company, we have a passion for, you know, making data as easily accessible for users. And one of the users that we care, you know, or a big group of users that we truly care a lot about are kids and families. And given that we have such a big role in kind of the tech and industry, or internet industry, you know, we feel that it's important for us to take a stake in this environment and truly educate and teach kids and teach families all about the ins and outs of the internet and how to be safe online, but also how to be positive online, especially now with kids being so digitally native, you know, growing up in a world where technology is all around them. We just want to ensure that we are providing the tools, the resources to help make the most of technology as it relates to families.
Are you getting any data in return back for all this?
No. So one of the things about the Internet Alchem is we're not collecting any student data, which is actually one of the biggest concerns that we have on the teacher side, as they'd like to kind of track student progress as they go throughout the program.
Mm-hmm.
And because we don't track any of that data, it makes it a little bit difficult for a teacher to understand, like, how far a student has gone through the program. We're not collecting anything. There is no login needed to use any of the materials for the Internet Awesome. As a matter of fact, the game is even, it's all web-based, so you don't even need to download an app for it. You can access everything from our site with no login or any type of information being collected.
And so how do you learn whether this is working or not?
Well, we keep a close pulse on social media to see what our teachers are saying. Since we launched the program, we've actually already updated it. So this past June, we launched the second version of it because we heard so much from teachers about what was missing in the curriculum and mm-hmm. how to kind of make it stronger. So we released kind of the second version in June. And so what we do is we talk to a lot of teachers. We listen to, you know, their needs that they're either communicating online on social media, the messages that they send us. So we want to make sure that the program is as up to date as possible with some of the opportunities and challenges that teachers see as it relates to students and the internet, but also in just kind of trends that we're monitoring over as well. And so we're continuously updating it. So that's one of the plans, is to continue investing in the Internet Awesome so that we can stay on top of everything that's going on. But we truly listen to teachers in terms of how to build out the content for the next iteration of the program, if you will.
Probably a lot of adults are more familiar with, obviously, Facebook and Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
How many platforms do you cover in this?
So this is a website. So it is, everything is located on the site itself. So if you go to, if you just search for Be Internet Awesome, Google.
I know what you mean by that, but I'm just saying, you know, a lot of parents don't even know where their kids are on the internet anymore.
Yes. So we cover kind of breadth of topics in this. So as I mentioned earlier, the Smart Pillar, we teach them all about sharing, right? What they're sharing on social media, what they're sharing on the internet. For the Alert Pillar, we teach kids how to spot real from fake online as it relates to phishing and scams. So email, right? So we talk about email, how to address email, how to spot, you know, digital banners on websites or in-app notifications. In the Strong Pillar, we teach kids all about privacy and security and protecting their personal information because it ties to their identity. So we teach them about passwords, right? Many of us, you know, myself included, before I actually went through the Be Internet Awesome program, used the same password for more than one website, right? And so we teach kids about, you know, developing strong passwords and how you do that, and how to just keep all of your secrets, if you will. That's what we call the personal information. How do you secure all of that? So we talk about kind of social media. We talk about just the internet broadly and how to protect your information. We also kind of bring light to email and in-app notifications. And in the family guide, what we've actually started to include is texting, right? So teaching kids and families about tone and how words on a digital screen can have an impact, negative or positive. We also are teaching parents about searching, right? So when they search for different topics with their kids, How do you identify a credible source versus a non-credible source? And so really we try and cover as many topics about the internet as possible, because it truly is meant to give a broad overview about the internet so that when a child goes online, they feel a little bit more confident with what they may come across because they've been taught to kind of be on the lookout or how to navigate these types of situations.
How long has Google been working on this?
Oh, my goodness. So this has been a long time coming. So we've done quite a number of different versions of this program, but it officially came to be Internet Awesome about a year and a half ago. So we launched it at the largest educator conference in the United States, which is ISTE. We launched it in 2017, I'm sorry. And, you know, since then, we've just been kind of overwhelmed with how much teachers have embraced this content, how engaged students are with learning about all of this stuff in a fun way. And so we're continuing to kind of understand what's the next version of the Internet Awesome. And the way our cycles work is we typically tend to release the new information every summer. So we're already working on the next version for 2019. So it's been around a year and a half now, but, you know, it's not going away anytime soon.
Jessica Covarrubias, thank you for joining us today to talk about it. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Jessica Covarrubias is the lead of Google's Be Internet Awesome project. We'll have a link for you to learn more if going forward on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Smart speakers were the beginning. Now we have smart screens. Amazon and Lenovo were the first to enter the smart screen market. Google has now joined them with its Google Home Hub. Joining us by phone to talk about that and other tech news is Android Central contributing editor Russell Holly. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So I feel like it's Google Day on All Sides. In your article, you called this device the, quote, the most impressive example of Google's design chops I've ever seen. Coming from you, that's a big deal. What are you so impressed about?
Well, they took a lot of the things that we've seen from the Amazon Echo Show and the Lenovo Smart Display, and they've just made it so compact. This is so much smaller than the other designs. It makes it so much easier to put in a kitchen or even in a bedroom or you know, kind of tucked away in a living room. It is the first of these designs that I really felt like could go anywhere in the house without experiencing any compromises. You know, I can, you know, feel comfortable putting this in my bedroom because there's no cameras or anything like that to be concerned about. Mm-hmm. Putting it in the living room makes it an excellent photo frame. And the screen on this is actually designed to get super, super dim. So that unlike a lot of photo frames where you've got that kind of that screen glare or the screen brightness kind of distracting as you're walking through a room, This is designed to be much dimmer so that it almost feels like an actual photo frame holding an actual photo as you walk through.
All right, I'm just getting to know Alexa. Why a screen?
Well, the whole idea here is being able to issue more visual information to go along with the audio information. So a great way to start off with, you know, an Amazon Echo or a Google Home, the speaker version is to ask it to start your day or to give you news feeds or things like that. And adding a display either to the Echo Show or to this Home Hub just gives you more information. If there's traffic on your way to work, it'll show you specifically where it is on a map on the screen automatically. Asking for the weather will show you a more detailed look of what the weather looks like for the day. News reports will show photos and in many cases video from the places that you've selected as kind of your trusted news sources. And you can call upon this in the kitchen, kind of my personal favorite place to have this, for step-by-step instructions for recipes and kind of video tutorials for cooking. The visual element just adds a lot to those experiences.
Yeah, I would kind of covet it for that purpose, for the recipe part of it. But what's the difference between this and just having a computer out on your counter, a small or a tablet, and just turning off the camera?
Well, there's two things. One, this is designed so that it can be, occasionally splashed with things. You don't have to worry about permanent damage. If I get grease on this, I can very easily wipe it down. The same can't really be said of a laptop keyboard, which I can say from experience is really hard to clean grease out of a laptop keyboard. there's also a price to keep in mind. You know, your laptop, if anything were to happen to it, also from experience, if you knock it into a sink of dirty dishes, that gets really expensive. If you do anything to this, the total price of this home hub is $150, which is not only pretty reasonably priced for what you're getting out of just a smart speaker, but it's also noticeably cheaper than the Amazon Echo Show.
What's the sound like?
It's pretty similar to the smart speakers that Google already has. So if you have used a Google Home Mini or a Google Home before, then this sound profile is really similar, where it's loud enough to fill kind of a medium-sized room or a small room. It's not quite loud enough, in my opinion, to keep up with a full kitchen of things going. So if I have, if I have more than one person in a kitchen and we're kind of using multiple devices, then it can be too quiet, in my opinion, to mm-hmm. really kind of enjoy the music that's coming over it. But in just about every other room in the house, it's great.
Now, how does it distinguish it from the other, devices like this, from the other makers?
The biggest thing here is that it's entirely Google software and this very compact design, which comes in a bunch of different very fun colors, including a really nice greenish blue that I really like. But the whole design of this is to go in a lot of the places these other displays are just not meant to go. The Amazon Echo Show is really great for a living room or a kitchen, but it's really not designed for the bedroom. And there's a ton of people who are just not comfortable having that idea of having a speaker like this with a camera in the bedroom. And the big reason for me to have something like this in the bedroom is it acts. The touch display on this can also act as like a smart home controller. So if I want to adjust my thermostat or if I want to mess with my lights or something like that, I can just speak out and have those changes made. But if I'd rather reach out and touch either to not wake up the person laying next to me or just because it's easier because it's right there, then I have that ability to kind of reach out and use that. So it's also kind of a nice bedside table thing. Although putting it on your bedside table kind of makes it the most expensive alarm clock you can imagine. but you could also use it like that.
Yeah, or to put yourself to sleep at night.
That's right.
Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Ghostbusters World is a new alternate reality game. It has hit the market. You like that too?
This is cool. This is, as much fun as I have had over the last couple of years talking about Pokemon Go, where you can kind of walk around in the real world and catch all of these creatures. It is very much targeted to a younger age. There are some older age people who really enjoy it, who've grown up with Pokemon and who enjoy kind of playing the game or just enjoy playing with other people. Mm-hmm. So it is a game that has kind of crossed that age divide in some respects. But the Ghostbusters world definitely appeals to an older group of people who would go out in the world and play. And that's the whole point here. Instead of running out and catching Pokemon, you are going out with groups of people and catching ghosts as they are flying around your city and your home and pretty much anywhere that you can go. A lot of the game mechanics are pretty similar.
But it's more complicated.
It is more complicated. First of all, there's kind of this story mode that you can go out and play by yourself. You don't have to be with a group of people. It doesn't require more than one person to play. So if you enjoy the idea of walking around and playing these games, but you're not super thrilled about playing with strangers, you have this whole campaign mode that you can walk around your existing parks and zoos and things and enjoy. But you can also really get into more complicated adventures with friends. To cooperate to take down kind of larger ghosts and more significant events that happen throughout the throughout the world as you walk around with friends.
Tell us how you catch one of the ghosts.
So it's a multi-step process, just like the Ghostbusters show. You know, you have your proton pack, which is built into your phone. You see the little proton pack nozzle on the screen, so you see the ghost in front of you, and you have to kind of lasso it with the proton pack, and then someone in your group, slides out the ghost catcher underneath of it, and then you kind of lower it down into the ghost catcher and seal it up, and then you've caught it.
Is it too hard for children to play? I mean, could people play with their kids?
I would definitely say that kids could play this. It would not appeal to quite as young an audience, just because there are more steps involved. And in some cases, it really does require that kind of group effort to really enjoy.
Uh-huh.
So it may not be as accessible to, say, 7 or 8 year olds. But most people who are going to be walking around outside with a phone on their own are going to be able to play this game with no problem.
You know, we were just talking with Warren Buckleitner earlier in the program of the Children's Technology Review, and he loves Pokemon Go. He talked about it, but he likes these kinds of games, but he worries about the cost, particularly for kids who maybe don't have unlimited resources.
Well, this is a really interesting conversation, because this gets played, Pokemon Go in particular, gets played in a lot of different ways. I actually, friends of mine have, used iPods that each one of the kids play. They were, I think, $50 or $60 when they got for each one of the kids, and they connect to a wireless hotspot that the mom runs when they go out and play. And that's a group of four kids who all go out and play in the same way. So there are ways to lower that cost and make it more accessible, but it is definitely a challenge because you can't, especially in a multi-child home, it's difficult to justify each one of these kids having a phone, especially when they're younger, and not using it as a communication device. If it's just a toy, that makes it much harder to justify.
Mm-hmm. And so how about Ghostbusters World? Is it comparable price-wise?
No, it requires a little more hardware to run Ghostbusters World in most cases. I don't think it would be quite as accessible as Pokemon Go.
Okay. You also wanted to talk about a new Retro Games Limited. It's releasing C64 Mini. What is C64? I don't remember it.
The Commodore 64 was, for a lot of people that are my age, like the first computer that they had in the home. You know, the Commodore 64 had, some very basic games, but it also, opened up to a lot of people the world of programming and creating your own, environments and things like that. So it was originally marketed as a way to, instead of buying a Nintendo console at the time, was buying this thing that was like an investment in your child's future, because computers were definitely the future, and so they should get one of these instead of just a game console. But it did also have games that they wanted to play. And so for people who had a Commodore 64 growing up, this is kind of the nostalgia hit aimed at them. This is a small keyboard with a joystick that emulates the Commodore 64 environment. So it has a whole bunch of the original Commodore 64 games on it that they can go through and play, complete with the joystick that feels very similar to the original Commodore 64 joystick. And this impossibly tiny keyboard where all of the computer stuff is kind of located inside for you to go through and play as though you were playing on the original Commodore 64.
But it's a mini. Does that change things much?
It is so small. Oh. Yes, this is a very small. The keyboard is big enough to type on, but it is not, in my opinion, big enough to type on comfortably.
Uh-huh.
So it's difficult. But I guess if you're used to typing on, say, like a smaller iPad or something, then you're probably familiar with the rough size and shape of the keyboard here.
Now, did you learn on a Commodore, or are you?
I had access to a Commodore, but I never owned a Commodore. So I had friends who had them, and I enjoyed going over and playing with them for a lot of these. But this was never. This was never a console in my house.
What was your first computer?
My first computer was one that my uncle and I built when I was 9.
Of course it was.
That ran, I think it was Windows 3.1.
Wow. Okay. All right. Now, you wanted to talk about an immersive video game that's about to hit the market. It's called Fallout 76. What's important about this?
So the Fallout franchise has always been this this kind of single-player adventure where you walk around in this post-apocalyptic world where only a handful of people were kind of sealed away in these vaults to protect themselves from nuclear fallout. And now they are roaming the world and trying to kind of reclaim it for their vision of what the future should look like. And throughout that, you know, a whole lot of other things kind of go wrong in the process. But it's always been kind of this single-player, very interactive, very immersive adventure that you really just kind of play yourself. And this new game that's coming out very soon, Fallout 76, is actually the first of the Fallout games to be online multiplayer focused. So this is, you know, in the same vein as the rest of the Fallout universe, but the idea is that you are entirely online with friends. So, it, you know, as you exit your vault, so are other people doing the same, and you are either going to work with them or work against them to kind of create your vision of what the restart of the world will look like.
Are you exiting the same vault, or are they different vaults and you find each other?
It's going to vary. You know, there's going to be some difference there. You know, you are going to start off kind of in your place, and there will be other people there with you. But this is kind of a special situation compared to the other Fallout games where there's going to be a lot of people playing at the same time.
What do you think? It's come out. They Fallout players can test a beta version ahead of the November 14th release date. Have you checked that out yet?
This is actually going to start tonight. I think if you are if you have access to Fallout 76 beta, it actually starts today. It'll start later. And the whole deal here is that if you have pre-ordered the game, then you are given a code to start this beta today. They're going to do one for a couple hours today, and then they're going to announce other dates in the not-so-distant future. But the whole idea is to make sure that the system is completely ready online so that when it does launch on November 16th, that everyone can kind of jump in and play at the same time. But if you are already excited about this idea and you kind of want to jump in and play, today is the opportunity to do that.
And it's not just a sample. It's the full game, right?
You'll have access to the full game for a couple of hours.
Okay.
Which isn't going to be enough time to, you know, blow up anything or anything like that. But it'll give you a really good idea of how the world is going to play and what it's going to feel like and what it is like to play this game with more than just the computer-generated characters.
Why? What different things? You said not enough time to blow anything up. I mean, what do players typically do in Fallout? I've watched my kid play it, but I never really got to the point. It was usually like running around with some dog or finding some weird guy on a, I don't know.
It's really a combination of resource gathering and this kind of long-term survival. So you wander around the world, you kind of have to survive the other things that have grown in humanity's absence. You know, so monsters that have kind of mutated from radiation and things like that. But you also have to just be very aware of your environment. You're constantly looking for food and water and medicine to keep yourself alive while exploring this wasteland.
And there's three versions that you'll be able to purchase, about $60 a pop, and up to a premium version of $200. Wow. What difference does that make? We just have about like 30 seconds, but wow.
Yeah, so there are going to be bigger versions that you unlock that come with physical items. One is actually a whole weird computer thing that you wear on your wrist that is difficult to explain, but it's very similar to the computer that all of the characters in the game will wear on their wrist. So it makes you feel like you're part of the adventure.
Russell Holly, thanks so much for your time, as always. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That's Russell Holly. He is a contributing editor at Android Central. And that's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks very much for listening. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.